This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello and welcome to the L&G Talks Asset Management podcast. I'm Nick Jardine, content manager for L&G's private markets platform. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Rob Martin, head of investment strategy and research for private markets, and Lucien Sun, head of cross-asset research. If you hadn't guessed from our collective titles, we're going to be talking all things private markets, not just what we've seen this year so far, but also the long-term view of where we see an opportunity in this asset class. Rob, to kick us off, the title of this podcast is Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which is a quote from a Shakespearean tragedy. I don't think it's been quite as bad as that in 2025 so far, but there's certainly been some drama. I think most of our listeners will be familiar with the macro picture, but why don't we just take a few moments to set the scene?
Thanks, Nick. You know how to start us off on a high note, don't you? No one needs us to recite all the policy drama from the past several months. Let's just say it's been a roller coaster, particularly for US assets. And that volatility in itself is obviously challenging, particularly for private markets where holding periods tend to be longer. That makes decision making harder. I mean, surveys of businesses and individuals have generally weakened pretty sharply. And markets are definitely debating the impact on the economy, but it is very likely to mean that the short-term growth outlook is weaker than it was at the start of the year, particularly for the US.
Thanks, Rob. So I want to take a look forward today. And maybe we should start with areas which are screening most strongly from a tactical perspective. I know that two asset classes we've identified here are real estate and the different investments that this entails, and investment-grade private credit. Why are you viewing these way?
Thanks, Nick. So our tactical views are based on the latest asset yield and how they compare against long-term average. And in this case, we use 10-year historical yield. Investment-grade private credit now ranks the highest in terms of relative attractiveness, followed by real estate. So those are the two asset classes you have identified earlier. Taking them in turn, we look at investment-grade private credit. Their current yield is around 5 to 7%, very much towards the top of historical range. That's largely been driven by the elevated interest rates, but actually also due to discipline of investment-grade lenders. It's an asset class that's very much in demand by institutional investors such as pension funds and insurers, but they've displayed really good discipline in terms of underwriting and pricing, and that's allowed illiquidity premium on investment-grade private credit to be maintained over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and switching over to real estate, the way we think about how we look at asset yields here is with net operating income yield. So that is cash income after the costs of managing the assets. And that's gone above average in the UK, in the US, and in continental Europe at the moment. And that is a reflection of the repricing in those markets that's taken place globally. Now, in the same way as with bonds, prices move inverse to yields. So lower prices has led to higher yields. Now, that said, even at the aggregate level, the yields in those markets are still only in very broadly the mid 4%. Actually, if you look at IG credit, you're looking at yields in the mid fives. So you also need growth to deliver an illiquidity premium that people would expect from a real asset. Now, the market itself, a diversified market exposure, will deliver some growth over the next 5 years, but that GDP slowdown we're looking at is going to make that tougher. So we're especially focused on areas that can deliver in a lower growth, higher inflation environment. And there are a few sources of that outperformance that we're looking at. Partly it's about sector strategy. It's focusing on areas with needs-based demand and which have constraints on supply. So you get a favorable demand-supply balance. And there is also an aspect of the style or the particular implementation strategy. And we see a real role for value creation through active management in this next 1, 3, 5 year period. So real estate overall is relatively good value, but to really deliver, you need to focus on particular areas of the market.
Thanks, Rob. And just to pick up on something that you said there, I think it's worth mentioning that we often talk about these needs-based real assets as showing some resilience as we look forward. Just for the benefit of our listeners, firstly, what do we mean by that term? And secondly, what's the source of this potential resilience that, that we're maybe going to see over the long term?
Yeah, so needs-based is another way of saying non-cyclical. So assets or styles of investment that are relatively less sensitive to economic activity, things that tend to be part of the fabric of society and the economy. In the real estate space, there are a couple of areas that we look at. One in particular is residential housing. This is a space where there is undoubtedly a global issue with housing supply and affordability. And what we have found is that investors can play their part in expanding housing supply, but still benefit from a relatively low volatility of demand. So there's a societal benefit, but equally a good investment case here as well. The other aspect that we look at a lot in within real estate is industrial real estate. Many of us are familiar with the big boxes that we see at the motorway junctions doing large-scale logistics. We see a particular opportunity to build out more localized logistics, actually, urban infill locations and increasingly specialist logistics like cold storage and other types of newer forms of logistics that are coming out of e-commerce and other parts of the economy. We see those two areas in particular having a very strong demand underpin and equally constraints on supply, which leads to a good investment case for clients.
So we talked about the definition of needs-based earlier. I think the definition has really evolved in recent years due to the emergence of megatrends. When we say megatrends, what we mean is those structural long-term shifts in society and the way we live, the way we work, the way we socialize, et cetera, et cetera. We published a report last year, touching very much looking at this. We called it the 4 Ds, deglobalization, digitalization, demographics, and decarbonization. And we think these four trends will drive long-term investment opportunities. And in most areas, the demand is already there, but the supply is definitely lagging. So there is a big demand-supply mismatch. So we're looking at huge capital requirement to create new assets to meet demand. So if I give an example, a very conservative estimate puts the total amount of data center investments for the rest of the decade at $250 billion. So that's got to be funded by private sector capital. A lot of it will be funded by equity, but increasingly, we think a lot of that is going to be funded by credit, particularly private credit. And private credit is already very well established in sectors like renewables, solar, wind, transport, and most real estate sectors. And we are seeing that asset class broadening into emerging sectors, so digital, definitely, energy storage, and more specialist real estate. And I think also worth noting here is the role of bank retrenchment. We very much saw that in the aftermath of the GFC, when banks pulled back from lending and actually private credit lenders stepped in to fill the gap and funded a lot of these needs-based type assets. Recent data suggests that we might be seeing another round of bank pulling back the lending as a result of the tariff volatility. So it could potentially be a very good opportunity for private credit lenders there.
Just to build on a couple of areas that Lucian mentioned there, I think within clean energy, there's been a lot of focus, and investors are now pretty familiar with the idea of investing in clean electricity generation, so wind farms, solar farms. I think one of the things that was, and we're still not sure what caused the big outage in Spain a couple of weeks ago, but one of the things I think that really brought to mind for many people is that this is about fundamentally reinforcing and expanding the electricity system in general. So that is about generation, but it's also about energy storage, and it's also about energy distribution. And that creates an enormous financing need and equally asset creation associated with it. On the digital side, just in the last few months, I mean, we've been debating this a lot as a business, the DeepSeek news. What does that mean for AI? I mean, there's still a lot of uncertainty about that. But one of the things we've certainly been reflecting on is that that is only one of the drivers behind digital infrastructure and the need for more of it. There's cloud computing in general, which is creating demand for purpose-built data centers. But also there's the whole issue of data sovereignty. And that is meaning that data storage capacity needs to be added in more places around the world. So that's creating a very broad-based demand that we think, you know, is really quite enduring.
Lucian, I know you were kind of talking about the role that the private credit is playing in terms of capitalizing on some of these trends. Just to shift gears, I think the one thing our listeners will be curious about is what the picture looks like for private equity. I think I'm right in saying that we saw some kind of tentative signs of recovery here in the first quarter of this year, but that was obviously before the arrival of US tariffs. I guess the question that I have is what needs to happen over the long term for this asset class to keep its appeal?
You're right, Nick. We absolutely need to look at what's happening in private equity, not least because it is the most mature, the largest private market asset class, and it has sizable allocations in investor portfolios. It's been struggling, I think, since the start of monetary tightening in 2022. That's very well publicized. But you know, I think the reality is more nuanced than headlines, and it's worth sort of digging under the bonnet to have a look at different parts of the private equity industry and see how they perform over the last couple of years. If we take buyout, so that's the core part of the private equity asset class, it has seen strong performance on paper, numbers between 15 to 20% increase in valuation over the last 3 to 4 years. Now, we are seeing investors basically voting with their feet. They're saying that I'm not getting capital back from my existing funds in private equity. I don't have the capital to recycle into new commitments, so I'm not able to do new commitments. How do you think asset class is going to get back on track? I think what will be very helpful is a bit of macro stability. It's very much what we expected early this year. But as you said earlier, the US tariffs have sort of thrown the spanner in the works. But so some macro stability would definitely be very helpful. And M&A recovery. That was very much the big hope of industry at the start of the year. It has shown some signs of recovery, as you say. And I think once we have a more settled period of economic conditions, the M&A recovery may well come. And that could help increase exits. It will help increase distribution and likely to improve investor sentiment there as well. Now, that's buyout. On the other end of the spectrum within private equity is venture capital. So that's the highest risk, highest return part of the asset class. Now, there we saw a sharp valuation correction quite early on in the cycle. So whereas earlier, so buyout saw a return of 15, 20% in the last 2-3 years, venture capital saw the opposite. They saw a reduction in valuation by roughly the same amount over the same period. And that is because it is riskier, the immature businesses and investors are far more sensitive to the impact of interest rates and bad conditions on the likely performance of those investments. But we are beginning to see more recovery there. I think that's been supported by a couple of factors. One is the fact that the entry point is frankly now more attractive. And secondly, you know, a lot of these companies are in sectors such as AI, automation, biotech, etc., very much aligned with the growth trends, the mega trends that we talked about earlier, and there's strong investor interest in those sectors, particularly in AI, clearly. So there is a lot of investor demand for those type of assets, and we could see venture capital recover potentially a bit earlier than buyout.
Thanks. So far we've talked about private markets in quite general terms, but like any asset class, we can diversify globally when making an allocation here. Can you talk a little bit about why this might be something that's on investors' minds?
Yeah, we talked about this in our 2025 outlook when we were setting the scene for this year. Deglobalization and the populist policies that are often linked to that is leading to more policy volatility. And the case study this year has definitely been the US. Exposure to the US has been a source of volatility for many investors. Now, the US is the largest, the deepest capital market in the world. That is not going to change. But we know that many clients are thinking about how to respond to this environment. And balancing US exposure with other markets is going to be a part of that. And that's as true in private market portfolios as it is on the listed side. And that means renewed conversations around the UK, around continental Europe, as well as around a number of Asia Pacific markets.
So just to shift gears a little bit, we've talked about where we see opportunity over the long term. I'm sure some of our listeners would like to hear about how I've actually kind of put this into action. I don't know if there'd be any examples you'd be willing to share about how we positioned ourselves, to set ourselves up for the future and take advantage of these opportunities.
One very interesting area I'd like to highlight is universities and investments linked to universities. So LNG as a firm, we already invest in lots of different university-related assets, including student accommodation or private credit to university borrowers. And one of our current research deep dives is around the idea of universities as an investment theme. So we are looking at the role that they play in the local economy and the benefit that brings, how they act as innovation hubs, attracting talent and developing new technologies. And last but most importantly, the investment performance of university-related assets versus the wider market. I think it's really interesting to note that university-related assets really span the whole risk-return spectrum. On the higher, higher quality, low-risk side, you've got investment-grade private credit, you've got secure income, real estate, and at higher risk, high return, and you can have development real estate and venture capital. So it's really broad investment universe, and investors can tailor their exposure to university related asset depending on their objectives. We also think university is a particular strength in the UK, as a country we punch way above our weight in terms of our science and technology, our research, and our ability to attract talent. And we also in the UK have policy tailwind. So the current government is aiming to grow the university spin-out sector and is investing in infrastructure in key university hubs. We also had a Mansion House Accord that was published earlier this week, which should encourage more capital flow into UK assets, which could benefit the sector.
I think what the area that I'm especially intrigued by is an emerging asset class on the debt side. This is debt for nature swaps, and they're really debt for nature restructurings. And these transactions, a private organization will buy the bonds of an emerging economy. Those bonds are then restructured to lower the interest costs that the issuing country pays. And a proportion of those savings is used to fund conservation initiatives. And one part of most of these deals is credit insurance that's used to make the bonds investment grade. And I think the thing that really stands out is that there are a range of benefits to this. The investor receives a complexity premium. The country in question reduces their interest cost. And maybe most importantly, this releases funding that then is ploughed into conservation initiatives. There are a ton of complexities with them that we don't have the time to go into now. But fundamentally, I think it's a really interesting example of a financial innovation that has real societal benefits. In the past year, we've seen deals in El Salvador, the Bahamas, in Belize, and in Ecuador. I hope we see a lot more of them.
Rob, Lucien, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information. Not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities, undertaking for collective investment in transferable securities regulations 2011 as amended, and as an alternative investment fund manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.